My name is Brian Anderson. I'm an alcoholic. And I am just delighted to be with you all tonight. I'm a grateful alcoholic. You know, as I mentioned last night when I had a chance to talk to you about emotional sobriety, I think that gratitude is the WD-40 on this deal for me. As long as I keep grateful, everything else seems to work. And I'm grateful for a lot of stuff. I am amazed at how many new guys there are here. And, you know, if there is a WD-40 that makes AA as a whole work, I'd say it's the new people. And I love being with the old-timers, don't get me wrong. I've got a whole bunch of heroes in this deal. You know, some of them, like these guys behind me. I'm told that this fellow that started this deal was killed on a 12-step call with a shotgun. This guy, Dr. Bob, carried our message to 15,000 people, or 5,000 people in 15 years. You do the math on that, that's about 5 a day, something like that, for 15 years. That's setting the bar pretty high. But I'm very grateful to be your speaker, and I thank you all those involved with thinking that I might be a good one. I hope I can measure up. But more importantly, as AA, as an entity, which you're very a powerful part of AA as an entity, I'm very glad that you all had the door open for me on June the 1st, 1993, when I walked in here. You know, for a man with 2 days, you know, that's a long time to be sober for a drunk like me that couldn't stay sober 2 days. I couldn't stay sober 24 hours when I got here. And I came in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, and something happened. There's kind of stories you hear around and stuff, and for me, one that really clicks is I had kind of spent my pre-Alcoholics Anonymous life as a zebra trying to fit in with a world full of ponies. And when I got here, I found the rest of the zebra herd. It was obvious that I was in the right place. My period of disbelief and judgment on Alcoholics Anonymous lasted about the first 20 minutes I was here. And I am very blessed in that way. You know, all of us have seen people struggle with accepting our program. But if you just sit down, you new guys, if you just hang around, over time, there gets to be just an immense amount of data. See, I'm a scientist. I'm a data guy, right? Show me the information. Show me the data. And the data on Alcoholics Anonymous is if I stick around and I sit down and I pay attention, miracles happen here. People wander in and almost every single one of them says, there's no way to get where I am from where I started. You know, it happens over and over and over again. It's an unbelievable tall pile of information leading me to accept the fact that there is a powerful and loving God behind all this. I mentioned my sobriety date, June the 1st, 1993. My sponsor is John C. He got sober in 1975. Never even got a chance to drink a light beer. They hadn't come out with light beer yet. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. You know. And my home group is the Monday Night Men's Supper Step Study of Alcoholics Anonymous in Houston, Texas. I invite you all to please come see us. We meet every Monday night, as we have done for almost 25 years now, at a member's home. We share a meal together. Fellowship, and then we study the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then we pray. And when those hairy-legged men leave my house, boy, is there a good feeling in that place that lasts. Now, I'm all in on Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I choke up during this talk, that's just what I do. I am so energized and so happy and grateful about being a member of this deal. You know, it's too bad we can't just touch somebody with that. You know? Everybody knows somebody, a family member. My own father. It's one of the greatest tragedies of my life and of my recovery. He was... I tried to 12-step him for 14 years after I got sober to no avail. And I ended up burying him of our disease. And... Yeah, it was tragic. And I really wish there could have been a way to have that be different. But I will tell you a little story about that, man. You know, I have a way of talking that I go way off on rabbit tracks, and then I'll come on back and we'll get to the point again. So I'm kind of halfway down a rabbit track with this story about Dad. But it's an important story about, and it ties into the fact that there's a God in this deal. You see... He didn't have ears to hear me 12-step him, right? He's my dad. Couldn't do that. But what he did, what God did for me, was he made it possible for me to put him in the grave with no regrets. Because one day I was over at his house. His neighbor was this trust fund baby, scotch guzzler and cocaine user that was holed up in his house. He says, "Brian, come with me." And he had befriended this guy, right? He goes over next door. All the drapes are down. Beautiful view, you know, but all the drapes are down, of course. And he goes to the door and he goes, "Hey, Joe, gotta come here and talk to my son. He's an Alcoholics Anonymous." So we go in his house. It's an old dark house, and this guy's drinking his whiskey and Dad's sitting over here, and I'm sitting across the coffee table from this guy, and I gave him my best stuff. And I wasn't talking to that guy. I was talking to this guy over here. God gave me the chance to 12-step my dad without actually 12-step, you know. So when I did have to bury him of this disease, I didn't have to feel like I coulda, woulda, shoulda. You know, he got it, both barrels. And I'm kind of digressing here, but my job here is in a general way to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'll probably tell you a lot more about what happened than anything else, because I'm a step guy. I'm a big book guy. I'm a literature guy. My home group is a step study. I'm at two other literature meetings a week. And I really believe, I'm an Orthodox member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's okay. That's okay. My job, as I'm told in our book, and I worked hard to keep this current, is to present to the new guys, and this is for you new guys, the kit of spiritual tools that we are given in Alcoholics Anonymous. This kit of spiritual tools looks like the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But see, I like the pictures that are drawn with the words in our literature. That makes it, I'm a tool guy too, right? I like to work with my hands. I got an old car I like to work on. And that toolkit, to me, in my picture, in my mind's eye, is made out of wood like those pieces that were auctioned off today, right? With brass fittings, beautiful toolkit. You open it up, and it's got tools of been used by a master craftsman. Beautiful, sharp, oiled, each one with its own precise application. But each of those tools is one of our 12 steps. My job, as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to present those tools to the new guy in such a way that hopefully he will pick them up and apply them in his life and get the recovery that we all that do that enjoy in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, a little bit about my background. I grew up, I was born in Seattle, to an alcoholic father, functional alcoholic dad. My family tree, if you shake it good, bottles fall out. Especially on my grandmother, my dad's mother's side of the family, they're all Swedes and Finns, and every single member of every single generation in my grandmother's side of the family are dead alcoholics, up to and including my father and his only sibling. I favor that group. You know, I kind of take after that bunch. So growing up, there was alcohol around a lot. I had a good childhood, heavy in sports. I was an accomplished athlete. Kind of had some weird skin problems as a little kid, which, you know, kind of lingered into later life and made me feel like I was a little bit different than others, you know. That eventually went away, but the feeling of being different from other people didn't very, very easily. As a kid, when I was, I guess, 13 years old-ish, I had somehow procured 2 quarts of Heidelberg beer, which is Rainier's cheap brand, I think, or Olympia's cheap brand. I don't remember which, but I sat alone in my bedroom and I drank those 2 quarts of beer, and it had happened for me, which I think a lot of you can identify with. That sense of ease and comfort came across me. And it was like that hole in my chest that the cold wind blew through, closed up. And I was good. This was going to work. This whole thing might just work out. And, so that started a slow ramp up of my drinking. You know, I was, as a young man, I fished in Alaska. That's how I put myself through college. That and a football scholarship. Before, you had to be a giant. You could just be a medium-sized guy with a bad attitude. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that a lot, but I found it very difficult to study science and chase girls and drink and play football at the same time. So the football went away. But this was a good time too. I mean, it was in the 70s, and you know, women didn't wear brassieres very much. There was all kinds of dry goods floating around and things to dabble with and whatnot. And, you know, and on spring break from high school, we, 3 years in a row, we'd take our pack frames out and go out to the interstate. And in 10 days, we'd hitchhike from Seattle all the way down the coast road to Tijuana and back. And boy, we had some epic adventures on those trips, I'll tell you. Wow. Amazing we've lived through that stuff, but you know, all this free love and all that, man, that was what I grew up in. And, you know, cause I was a sportsman, you know, I was in the, jock, if you will. I, you know, one of these Alaska trips, I came back with a load of cash and ended up being the financial backer to the guy that sold dry goods in the parking lot. You know, I was the silent partner. And, it's funny, that guy today, I'm not going to name any names, but he does the Wall Street stock report on the AM radio station. And so, you know, I mentioned drugs here. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I dabbled with more than I can even remember. I never got really fully serious about anything. Marijuana maybe, but you know, all that alcohol was always present. And at the end of the day, when I got into a working life outside of school, it all winnowed away, and there was nothing left but the booze. And but I think at the same time, the fact that I got sober at 36 years old is in part because I did do some outside substances. You know, I think that accelerated things for me a bit. So I started working offshore. I graduated from college in 1980. Immediately, that was just a boom time in the offshore oil business. Got a job through the mail, basically. Finished my last test on a Friday. I think Saturday I was on a plane headed to Alaska to go do a survey, a geophysical survey, and proceeded to work offshore and on survey ships all over the world. And for a young guy, man, that was really cool. You know, and I went to places where, and it was a time where before there were things like AIDS, you know, we could live out our wildest dreams and have change in our pocket from a $20 bill, you know, in some of the places that we worked. It was incredible, really. But all that fueled the beast, you know, it all fueled the beast. I was still young enough to be bulletproof and young and stout man. You know, I could handle this stuff. I did have some terrible hangovers. I was affected pretty much by my drinking. I didn't really realize that it was slowly escalating, but it was. And then eventually, I progressed to get a management position, right? And I was on the beach doing management work, and through my offshore survey time, I had like enforced sobriety when I was offshore, right? So 6 months of the year to 9 months of the year, I couldn't drink, but the other 3 months was party down, right? It was good, but so that kind of also stretched out my progression of my alcoholism. Well, when I got a job on the beach, that all changed. I could drink all the time now. And, you know, my alcoholism progressed. That first wife who I married at 20 years old brought home a load of books from the New York City Library and plunked them on the... We were living in Manhattan at the time. She was an aspiring actress. And on alcoholism. And so that was kind of, for me, maybe the point at which I kind of realized that between that and my genetic history of my family, with drinking, that, you know, maybe I had a problem with alcohol. You know, so maybe just started that first half of the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol. And, you know, it did progress. And then sometime around the age of 33-ish, I crossed that line to where I was drinking. Prior to that time, I was drinking because I decided to drink. And after that, I just drank every day. And that decision had been taken away from me. I no longer had the power to make that decision on my own. So, about 36, my wife and I had been, this is wife number two, been trying to have children, and she suddenly came up pregnant. And, you know, we had gotten together because she was also a heavy drinker. Loved me because even though she blacked out, I'd just toss her in the car and we'd go home and she wouldn't get in trouble. But once she got pregnant, it took a couple of months for her to fess up she was pregnant, but once she did, she had to not drink. And because she was a blackout drinker, she had, prior to that, not seen me in all my glory when I was drinking, right? So that got complicated. She suddenly got to see how Brian drank. And that, the heat started coming on there a little bit, you know, and not a little bit, a lot. And so I was blessed. This pregnancy progressed normally, And when she was 6 months pregnant, I woke up on another hangover morning. I must have had 1,000 in a row leading up to this morning. And I'm sitting in bed, and I got a visit from, nearest I can say, it was like the ghost of Christmas future. You know, I had a moment of clarity. And in that moment, I got a glimpse of what would be the reality, what would be the upbringing of that little girl if Daddy would continue to drink like he was. And it was heartbreaking because I had grown up that way. And it was profoundly important for me that this kid get a chance to do it different. I had, by this time, had developed some physical problems. I got in a couple ambulance rides before for alcohol poisoning, and there had been some physical issues happen. But that bottom, that day, was an emotional bottom, and it was rock bottom, all the way down to the rock. And I was desperate. I had to do something. So I found a counselor, went to this counselor, and he said, listen to me for about 4 or 5 minutes, said, Brian, you're an alcoholic. If you want to stay sober, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said also that if you want to stay sober, you got to get on your knees every morning. Ask for a sober day to the God of your understanding. And if you're still sober at night, get on your knees again and give thanks. I wasn't real red hot about that solution, but you know, thank God I was in enough pain to follow instructions. So I mentioned already about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and finding my crew of zebras, right? That my step, you know, my unmanageability and my powerlessness over alcohol was very apparent. And, you know, it was in that meeting, and as you'll see as I'm talking here, you know, I kind of wander through my experience with the steps. I think that's important, especially for the new people. That's where our solution is, right? And so at that first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a desire chip, the only one I've really had to get. We call them desire chip. I guess you call them a white chip here. But I got one of those, and I still carry one in my pocket. But what was pitched to me or sold to me, I think the one thing that AA sells, you know, or pitch, I'm a sales guy, right? So I think in those terms. The one thing we sell here is hope. Everything else is free, you know, but we sell hope. You can have hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me things like keep coming back and don't drink, hang with the winners, you know. And for me, that was an important piece, you know. And you guys, you all here represent winners to me, all of you. Because you're at this conference, you're doing this deal, you're obviously serious about your recovery. Found some heroes and emulated them, you know. So, also in that first meeting, I experienced step two without even knowing what step two was. I came to believe that if I did what you do, then I, like you, could be a sober man. I could live my life as a sober guy and be free from alcohol. So that happened. My daughter was born when I was 99 days sober. There I am, barely sober, a walking nerve ending, holding this baby girl and seeing God's bright sunlight. I tell you, I've never, ever in my life felt closer to God than I did have in that moment. And that little girl was an angel sent to me and this second wife of mine. She was born with an overhand knot in her umbilical cord around her neck. doctor said she'd never, ever delivered a baby in that condition that had lived. That little girl's 30 years old now, just perfect young lady, you know. You know, and to the newcomers, you know, I got to tell you, go out and drink if you must, but that's not a necessary part of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll always have a chair for you, but you don't have to go out. We don't have to tell you keep coming back. In fact, we should just say stay. Just stay. If you're here, you fully earned and paid for that seat. You don't have to do anything else. I'm sorry, I need to shift back to I statements. I don't like it. That hits a filter on me when I start saying, you got to do this, you know. But anyway, I feel rather strongly about that, if you hadn't been noticed. Step three for me was a very powerful experience. My first sponsor kind of just blasted right past it, you know, thinking that I needed to do a four step. And we never really did a formal get on your knees four step. And I hung around guys that had, and I always felt like I missed something, you know. I didn't get the full deal. And so I actually asked a friend if he would do it with me. And we did that. And it was a profoundly powerful thing for me. You know, there's a place in this world for rituals. You know, like if I'm going to get married, I'm not going to go down to the courthouse. I did that once and it didn't work very well. I'm going to stand up here in front of God and everybody and tell you all, I love this woman. I want to be married to her. Please bless us with your presence. And that's kind of how I feel about a third step. I, by God, I'm going to get on my knees and I'm going to do a third step. You know? And it's powerful. Don't cheat yourself. Do it. Do the whole thing. So, now what? Did a third step. Now what? Well, our book says that decision, although powerful, doesn't really mean much. It'll have little effect unless it at once followed by step four. Now I'm thinking, okay, all you guys that are fresh in the program, why do I gotta do this four step? You know? Why? Well, the question really is answered pretty clearly in the chapter How It Works, because they say it's going to identify and be rid of the things that are blocking me. Blocking me? Blocking me from what? Well, blocking me from that power greater than myself that I need. You see, in step one, you all told me that what I had was an allergy to alcohol. If I put alcohol in this body, I have a biochemical reaction, unlike normal temperate drinkers. It triggers a craving for more alcohol, and I'm off. That's exactly what happens to me when I drink. Okay, don't drink, right? Covered that. Well, there's also, as Tom was mentioned this morning so eloquently, there's this part about the mental obsession, right? That, I'm told by you all, requires a spiritual solution. I need to have a spiritual solution to that craving for alcohol, or that obsession. That lie that tells me, that crazy lie that tells me that this time it'll be different. So, my four-step experience was pretty interesting. My first one, my first sponsor didn't give me a whole lot of guidance, but I had heard and I'd been in meetings and okay, write the bad stuff. Go. You know, so I got pads of paper and pencils and got everybody out of the house and made a pot of coffee. And once I started on that, I wrote for about 3.5 or 4 hours. Solid. And what I experienced through that process, and I still do to this day, This one was ultra profound, though, because I'd never done it before. But that stuff that's in here, that nasty, rancid junk in here that drives me crazy, makes me want to drink to make it go away, it actually felt like it was flowing up my shoulder, down my arm, into that pencil and onto that paper. And each, it was like the guy in the magic show with the scarf, the endless scarf. You know, the more I put down, the more came out. And I wrote solidly for 3.5-4 hours. By the end of that time, and when I put that pencil down, I had another spiritual experience. That being the fact that I had no idea all this stuff was blocking me. When I put that pencil down, I stood up and I went outside. I could smell better. I could hear better. I could see better. It was like somebody, I'd been living under a tent or something, or under a tarp. So that was pretty cool. That was really neat. Sharing it with my sponsor, you know, what really made sense about that was the fact that it made me feel, of course, when I first came in, I felt like I'd found my tribe, but I really felt like I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous when I shared my fifth step with another member. Felt like I'd been given the secret handshake, right? And that was, felt good. That felt really good to be fully a part of this thing. And the fact that although I had some things in that inventory that were not very good. In fact, I was very ashamed of some of the sexual stuff. I didn't get shamed he shared with me some of his stuff that was similar. And I felt like I was part of this deal. And sharing some of my worst stuff with fellows that I sponsor seems to really help a lot. Both of us. You know, that transparency I was talking about last night. When I'm transparent with you, you get licensed to do the same with me. So, patiently my sponsor heard me out. That was really important. So then we wander into my experience with step 6 and 7 was probably not unlike a lot of you, where I read the two paragraphs, said the prayer, good, move on, done. Well, it's not been that simple in the longer haul. Those character defects, although that seems to be the only way I'm rid of them, is by surrendering them in a heartfelt prayer to my higher power. The willingness part and the preparation part and the getting to the edge of the cliff part on giving up a character defect, I've gotten real cozy with, is not easy. And there's a couple of men in here that heard me mention last night a piece that has been very powerful for me in my recovery life, and that is a special meeting we put together for step 6 and 7, where we got 4 or 5 guys that know each other pretty well and can be intimate with one another on a deeper level than just a walk-in AA meeting. And we have an AA meeting, but it's about step 6 and 7. And it's inclusive of both the opportunity to challenge each other about our character defects. First of all, fess them up. Challenge each other on them. And also be accountable about doing the things required, including surrender, to be rid of those things. And each of the men involved in that process gained a breakthrough. So if you haven't looked hard at step 6 and 7 lately, I'd suggest you maybe circle back that way. It helped me a lot. Um, You know, step 8 and 9, it's hard not to talk about them together. Step 8's just a simple list. You know, in fact, in some cases where I've got perhaps a sponsee who's reluctant to get started on the process, I'll just write his 8-step, get it pretty well fleshed out for him, you know, and hand him the pencil and say, okay, these are the people I heard about in your 5th step. You know, let's move on from here. Well, you fill out the rest. But step 9, boy, I tell you, that was a freeing experience. Freeing experience. I had so many fears about that. And, you know, like it says in the 12 and 12, one of the things a couple of things about that process that are really important. One was talking it over with my sponsor. Without that guidance, I would have been all screwed up and made some very ill-advised attempts at amends. He also made it very, very clear what the difference was between an apology and an amends. They've heard me, all those people out there have heard me say I'm sorry. How many times? It has no impact, right? It's a useless term, basically, to most of the people in my life. But if I go to those same people and say, I was wrong. What I did was wrong. I deeply regret my actions, and I'm here to make it right with you. That is an amends, right? And then take an action to follow that up. That my sponsor helped me immensely with that part. And then, you know, the other part that just seems to shake out of it is that, you know, there was one in particular that my sponsor had marked off my list. My ex-wife, my first ex-wife, because she'd run off with another guy and whatever, you know. And, I told him a story that really wasn't all the truth. So about 8 years later, I'm shaving my face and I'm thinking about somehow that came into my mind. And I knew that I had to call her and make amends. I had to do that. I took action and we were both set free. It wasn't all your fault. It wasn't all your fault, Pat. And she just came unraveled and so did I. You know, we were both free. You know, another part about the amends thing that I'll mention is that just really, it kind of ties back to the resentment list, the resentment inventory in step 5. Something that you guys taught me that really blew me away. And that is, you know, I don't think I'm unique in having that one or two resentments that, you know, I write about them. I pray for this person. I make, you know, I do all the stuff that's indicated, right? You know, in the process to be free of it. I go through a 5th step, 4-step, 5th step with my sponsor, and perhaps I pray for them for 30 days. Even then, that's still persistent, right? Well, somebody told me that what I needed to do if it was still bugging me at that point is go make amends to that person. What? You know? Yes, that was what it took. Because see, if I've got a resentment that's that pervasive, I've got something going on in that deal, right? I got a dog in the fight. There's something Brian did that I got to be clean about. Classic example. My dad never went to any of my football games. Some bitch never showed up for anything. And I had a huge resentment against him for that. This is all the way from Pee Wee's up through college. But, you know, when I finally went to him and made my amends to my dad, giving him full credit for all the things he did right, instead of just picking on the things he did wrong, I was free. And he was free. You know? It doesn't make sense. Why would I go make amends to that person? I have a huge... Well, it works. That's why. Step 10 for me is pretty cool, actually. I'm with Joe and Charlie. They don't call steps 10, 11, and 12 maintenance steps. They insist that they're growth steps. And I think that's true. That's very true for me. I can't stay stopped in this deal. If I stay stopped, I'm going backwards. So, step 10 for me is keeping my side of the street clean. You know, there's a lot of different ways people do these things. The way mine looks is I've got a legal book, a journal, and I do probably 20 pages a year in that thing. You know, I get snarled up with something, I'm angry about something, confused. It's the same process that I talked to you about in my fourth step. Once I start putting that pencil on paper and start writing that stuff down, it's like there's a transference out of my tangled up head and heart onto that paper. And it's almost as though I kind of levitate back and I can start getting an objective view of this thing instead of having it own me, right? It's a fabulous process. Step 11 is a grand adventure, you know. It's a grand adventure. I love step 11, you know. And what I've really been thinking about lately about step 11 is that part about sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. My conscious contact with God. If I'm conscious, I'm awake. So that means the whole time between being awake and being asleep, I'm to be in contact with God. I don't know how that works for any of y'all, but for me, that's not how I live my life. You know, I want to live that way, but I don't live that way. So the goal for me is by using these tools of prayer and meditation. Again, last night I mentioned about meditation. I had no meditation practice for 29 years. So suddenly I come into a meeting like the one this morning where we're sitting in a group having a meditation and I finally get it. I finally get it. And today I meditate every day at least 10 minutes and it makes a huge difference in my ability to maintain a conscious contact with the God of my understanding. You know, further, it gives me very specific directions on how I ought to pray, pretty limited. I expand on that quite a bit. But I do include, in fact, even when I'm fishing, I have a favorite prayer about, Lord, please, if it be your will, that's the important part, please bless us with smooth seas and big fish. And you know, that's another piece of my, you know, as we move into step 12, that's a big piece of my life these days. I've been retired a few years. And like is described in our book, many of us are in such a position where they can devote most of their time to this work. That's me. I do a lot of AA stuff, and it gives me great joy. Working with other alcoholics, that's the great payoff of this whole thing. And I love having all you new guys here. I hope there's maybe something I'm saying today that you can hang on to or that might resonate with you. You see, when I got here, the fact that people were just talking about their own experience, their own strength and hope and want nothing for me except success in staying sober. And the fact that they said, you want to go drink, you can go knock yourself out, kid. But if you want to stop drinking, we got a chair for you right here. Pull it on up, join up. I love that. Nobody was trying to sell me anything. And, you know, that's kind of how I've been doing it these days. I, You know, in my observation of certain, in my program, you know, things go through cycles. I go to more step meetings. I go to more mixed meetings. I go to a little more, you know, church meetings. I go to more clubs, whatever. You know, this, go to more conferences. It's just kind of changes. I get a new service job. And right now, I love where my AA program is gone to because it's old school, right? It's like my home group is old, is an old school cottage meeting home group. My program seems to be the get in the car method of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm driving around Houston, Texas with a car full of new guys all the time. You know? And I challenge you to feel sorry for yourself if you're doing that kind of stuff. It just doesn't, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You know? And of course what happens as a result of that, I end up with a vast array of friends and brothers in sobriety. You know? And what can be grander? What can be grander than to have friends that you've reached out with your hand to and help them get the lights back on? And help them return to humanity. You know? I'm a pretty good Christian. You know? You don't hear people say that much in AA. Some people say it's, you shouldn't say that. Well, I am. And it is okay to be a Christian in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's okay. Just like it's good to be anything else. I'm not gonna evangelize to anybody. But I'm not going to hide it either. And it's for me, the God of my understanding wants me to be his hands and feet, to go out and look for lost sheep. What better hunting ground for lost sheep than Alcoholics Anonymous? You know? I love parables. Our book, our literature is full of, you know, the gaunt prospector, the jaywalker, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, all this kind of stuff. And one of my favorite AA-ish, this isn't conference approved, the New Pair of Glasses book, which is a transcription of a men's weekend retreat by Chuck Chamberlain. For you new guys, if you don't have a copy of it, get a copy of it. It's a great book. But he does his own version, interpretive version of the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son in there. And it's fabulous. It's fabulous because that's what, in my view, we all are. We're a bunch of prodigals. You know? And another part he talks about in that book, I won't belabor this, but I'm a fisherman, so this appeals to me. You know, he tells a story about there's a couple of salmon out in the Pacific Ocean, and they're swimming along, and a whale comes by, says, "Water's pretty nice today, huh, boys?" And these two salmon look at each other and say, "Water? What's water?" So they swim all the way to Japan and back looking for water. And the water is equivalent to the spiritual, the God. Where is the God in Alcoholics Anonymous? That's what he's talking about with that example. You know, it's all around, everywhere. How much time do I got, bud? 10, okay. Well, I might be done before 10 minutes, guys. I'm just about ready to wrap up, but I do want to say a couple of things in general here. AA recovery statistics, right? Recovery statistics. I've heard a couple of times this weekend that people heard in their treatment centers that, you know, 1 in 10 of you, if you're lucky, will get sober. My personal experience is that of the people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous and work 100% of our program, 100% of those people will stay sober. Yeah. What is it they say? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed God. That's my personal observation. That's my truth. I believe it to my core. You know? Problem is, not that AA doesn't work. It's that fewer people are working the entire program, I guess. But it's there. It's there to embrace. It's there to own. Make your own. You know? These guys did this. Go out and do this. Why not? Why not? Leave a mark. Help somebody. Go the extra mile. You know, in this deal, it's intriguing. It's hard to understand, maybe, for you new guys. But there's absolutely nothing to figure out about Alcoholics Anonymous. There's only things to do. Right? Again, back to new pair of glasses. Old Chuck, he says, he was the guy that coined this phrase, you know, I can act my way into right thinking, but I can't think my way into right acting. I've got to get off my ass and get to work. You know, we got that chapter in our book, Into Action, right? Thank God it isn't Into Analysis. Or Into Figuring It Out. So, I'm about done with my walk around the park here, fellas. I wish all of you great success, wonderful health of your God-given sobriety. You know, share it. Please share it. This is the greatest gift in the world. I am the most blessed man. I come from a line of dead alcoholics. Why me? How did it stop here? Why me? I don't know why, but I do know that I've got two daughters, 30 and 28 years old, who have never seen Daddy drunk. Thanks to you guys. And that, my friends, is a debt I will never fully pay off. I'll be paying in that bank for a long time. Another thing about those two girls, genetically they're screwed. But they were raised in a sober home, and you know, maybe they got a chance to not have to come this way. But my theory about that is that I can't, just like my own father, I won't be the guy to help them. When the time comes, you guys and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous can. Therefore, my job is to keep putting my pennies in that AA piggy bank, helping you guys to my best of my ability so that this thing is alive and well and healthy when they show up. And they don't get a watered down version of this deal. And then when I sponsor somebody, it's in the book. They don't get my interpretive version, you know, because if I give my interpretive version of our program to you, and then, you know, I guess when I take you through the steps, I'm not just going through the steps, we're teaching this other person how to be a sponsor, right? And if I've modeled to this person something besides what's the black part in this book, well then, they're encouraged to do the same thing to the next guy, and the next guy. And that, a few times down the road, it looks nothing like what's in that book. So, I guess I've blabbed just about as long as I'm gonna. But I'm sure filled up being here. I thank you for coming here and listening to me, and hopefully there's something you can use. If I can be of service to any of you, or you'd like to talk more about anything I've talked about, I'd be delighted to talk more about. And if you ever come to Houston, please, please, join me on a Monday night. We'll break bread and study the steps. Thank you.